Good morning, everyone out there. This is Jane, reading to you from the News Gazette on September 9th, Wednesday. I hope you've had a good week so far. Looks like the weather is getting warming up again. So get all your gear, your ice and your fans and your air conditioners all geared up again. I'll start this morning with some local news. From the University of Illinois, school is barely back in session and we already have some threats to residence halls. An Urbana man has been charged with threatening a school building and trespassing on state-supported land following a report of armed subjects late Monday night at a University of Illinois residence hall. The report resulted in a series of campus-wide Illini alert notifications warning U of I students and other campus residents to be cautious in the area of the incident. Devante Tross, 20 years old, a juvenile whose identity has not been released, were arrested. Tross appeared in arraignment court Tuesday afternoon. U of I police were dispatched around 11:15 p.m. Monday to Bousfield Hall at 1214 South 1st Street in Champaign for reports of two people knocking on doors and threatening residents. Once they arrived on the scene, the person who made the report told them that the two people had been acting strangely and were making vague threats about having guns. A police statement released Tuesday said that the Illini alert was activated out of an abundance of caution while additional officers responded to the scene. Police established a perimeter around Bousfield Hall, while specialists at the Real-Time Information Center reviewed security footage. Programs used in the center allow staff to simply select any area on campus and bring up feeds of any cameras within the selected area. This would have made pulling up footage from within the building and surrounding area very simple. The specialists quickly located suspects through that video review and passed them on their locations to officers on scene who detained both of them. Neither had a weapon when police searched them. Both Tross and the juvenile were arrested on preliminary charges of making terrorist threats and criminal trespass to the state-supported land. The juvenile was also preliminarily charged with obstructing identification. The juvenile was released to their guardian. Tross was held overnight until his appearance in arraignment court. While he was granted pretrial release in accordance with state law, Tross was given a no-contact order with the entirety of what Champaign County Judge Brett Olmsted referred to as the campus rectangle, which is bordered by University Avenue, Lincoln Avenue, Windsor Road, and Neal Street. Despite the arrests and charges, the investigation into the incident remains ongoing, and U of I police are seeking evidence or information from witnesses. Those wishing to remain anonymous can contact Champaign County Crime Stoppers at 217-373-8477 or 373tips.com or via the free P3 Tips mobile app. Information submitted to Crime Stoppers is completely anonymous. Calls are routed to a third-party national call center that receives the information, completes a form, then passes the tip to the appropriate law enforcement agency. Caller ID tracking is not used and conversations are not recorded. And some local environmental news out of Gibson City. Ford McLean Carbon Sequestration Project back on the table. Gibson City's One Earth Energy ethanol plant has resumed seeking regulatory approval for its proposed carbon capture and storage project, to be known as the OES Pipeline. One Earth Sequestration, LLC, a subsidiary of One Earth Energy, LLC, is proposing to build a 5.4-mile, 8-inch diameter pipeline to transport liquid carbon dioxide captured from the ethanol plant in the Jordan Industrial Park on Gibson City's west edge to a single sequestration well in eastern McLean County near Saybrook, where the CO2 would be sent thousands of feet underground to be stored, said One Energy President CEO Steve Kelly. The project scope has changed slightly from past plans, which had called for a 16-inch diameter, 5.92-mile pipeline, plus two sequestration wells, Kelly said. The project now includes four proposed monitoring wells in McLean County, too, instead of only three, Kelly said. The project is back on the table after the state's two-year moratorium on carbon capture and storage permits expired, and the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration issued updated federal pipeline safety regulations this summer. The project initially expected to cost $19 million and will require the issuance of a Class 6 permit by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for the injection well, plus a certificate of authority by the Illinois Commerce Commission to build and operate the pipeline. It will also require the issuance of special use permits for the well in McLean County and possibly the 3.4-mile section of pipeline in Ford County, too. OES has already applied to the EPA for the well permit. While the permit was originally for three wells, according to the EPA's website, only one is now planned, Kelly said. Public comments on the EPA's intent to issue the permit are due September 23rd. And can be made through the docket on the agency's website. Also, the EPA will conduct a public hearing on the permit application from 6 to 9 p.m. on September 22nd at the Countryside Campground Event Center in Gibson City. The ICC's public hearing process for OES's original application from 2023 was suspended on June 10, 2024, after the statewide moratorium was passed by the legislature. Kelly said the application must now be refiled, which will start over the ICC's public hearing process. With the project, carbon dioxide would be captured directly from the fermentation process at the ethanol plant, rather than being released to the atmosphere. The CO2 would be compressed into a supercritical fluid and injected more than 6,000 feet underground for permanent storage within the 2,014-foot thick Mount Simon Sandstone Reservoir, according to OES. The project would capture 521,000 metric tons of CO2 annually, the equivalent of removing 123,999 gasoline-powered vehicles from the road for 1 year, the company said. The project would also enable OEE's production of low-carbon ethanol and sustainable aviation fuel, it said. The proposed injection well and monitoring well sites are outside the mapped boundaries of the Mahomet Aquifer, a major groundwater resource in east-central Illinois, OES noted. Some area residents have expressed concern that the aquifer could be contaminated with a CO2 leak. And here's a news about a local Illinois issue that has people very divided. The headline reads, "Judge weighing effort to halt Illinois' medical aid in dying law." Illinois is set to become the first Midwestern state to allow terminally ill adults to take life-ending medication prescribed by physicians when the law goes into effect late this week. But a federal judge is weighing whether to block the End-of-Life Options for Terminally Ill Patients Act, or EOLA, from its Saturday operative date after hearing arguments in a lawsuit that alleges it discriminates against people with disabilities. The suit also claims the law runs afoul of federal law, including the Americans with Disabilities and Affordable Care Acts. Thomas Geohagen, who represents the disability rights groups, physicians, and disabled Illinoisans who brought the case, told U.S. District Judge John Tharp that the law upends the millennia-old tradition of the Hippocratic Oath, a pledge doctors make to first do no harm. As a result, Geohagen argued the law will result in the severe impairment of the relationship a patient with disabilities has with his or her physician. Disability rights advocates fiercely oppose the 2-year effort to pass the law, warning that physician bias in perceived quality of life may make doctors more inclined to encourage life-ending treatment over other options for people with disabilities. On Friday, Geo Hagen contended this risk of coercion could be exacerbated by the reality of the American healthcare system, in which people with disabilities are often also poor or on public aid. Other countries that allow medical aid in dying, like Canada, have socialized medicine systems, he pointed out. But the attorney defending the law on behalf of the state argued that it contains a key stopgap. Physicians are only allowed to discuss lethal options with a terminally ill patient if the patient is the one who brings it up. The law only applies to adults with less than 6 months to live, a prognosis that must be confirmed by 2 independent physicians. Patients must make the request for lethal medication both verbally and in writing, and doctors are required to inform them of alternate hospice care and pain control options. Additionally, a patient requesting the medication must pass a mental evaluation by a physician to determine that they are mentally capable of making the decision and not facing undue influence. And I think that article provides a natural segue, if you will permit, into today's obituaries. Let's start with Dennis Carpenter of Rantoul, who passed away on Saturday, September 5th, at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana. A visitation will be held at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday, September 12th, this coming Saturday, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center's Lux Chapel, Grove Avenue, Rantoul, Illinois. Immediately following the visitation, please join the family for a party at the Rantoul VFW to celebrate Dennis's life and legacy. Come share stories, raise a glass, listen to good music, and celebrate the wonderful life he lived. Next, Herschel Craig, or Gene Craig, 94 years old, of Danville, passed away Friday, September 4th, at Hawthorne Inn of Danville. A service to celebrate the life of Gene Craig will be held at 6 p.m. on Sunday, September 13th, at Bismarck United Methodist Church in Bismarck, Illinois. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. prior to the service, also at the church. He will be laid to rest on Monday, September 14th, at Holt Cemetery in Chrisman Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center, Vermilion Street in Danville. Memorials in his name may be made to the Bismarck United Methodist Church. Next, Louis Durso of Mahomet passed away on Friday, September 4th at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana. A visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Friday, September 11th at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center's Mahomet location on Churchill Road in Mahomet. A funeral service will immediately follow the visitation. Next, Stanley Giles. Stanley Giles, 97 years old, of Champaign, passed away on Saturday, September 5th. A memorial contributions may be made to St. Matthew's Catholic Church in Champaign, where he was a member. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, September 11th at St. Matthew Catholic Church, Champaign. The burial will be in St. Mary's Cemetery, Pasodum. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 10th, that's tomorrow, at Morgan Memorial Home in Savoy. Next, Xavier Hilson, only 33, of Urbana, passed away August 25th, 2026. Celebration of Life services will be held on Friday, September 11th at New Free Will Baptist Church, Grove Street, Champaign. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. with services following at 11 a.m. Pastor Herbert Burnett will officiate. Next, Leland Lust, 98 years old, of Hammond, passed away on Monday, September 7th, at Savoy Place Memory Care in Savoy. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday, September 13th, at the Hammond United Methodist Church. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service at the church. Burial will be at the Hammond Cemetery. Next, Lorraine Phillips, 90 years old, of Rantoul, died on Monday, September 7th, at Accolade Healthcare of Paxton Senior Living. And that's all the information we have about her. And here a couple, Edith and James Sims. Edith Sims, 96 years old, of Hoopston, passed away on Friday, September 4th, at Gibson Area Hospital in Gibson City. Her husband of 73 years, James Edward Sims, 95, of Hoopston, passed away at 10:30 Sunday, September 6th, at Williamsport Nursing and Rehabilitation. A joint visitation will be held from 10 to 11, Friday, September 11th, at Anderson Funeral Home in Hoopston, the Masonic Rites for Ed being conducted at 10 a.m. Funeral services for both will follow at 11 a.m. Friday at the funeral home, with Pastor Brian Langdock officiating. Burial will follow in Floral Hill Cemetery with military rites accorded by Hoopston American Legion, Post 384. Now for one of my favorite rubrics, the Farm Family of the Week. On Wednesdays and continuing through harvest season, the News Gazette's Rob Lacates will spotlight a farm family. And this week, it's the Duzan, D-U-Z-A-N, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, of Hume. Tara Barrett Duzan started her career in journalism, and for 7 years, it was her world. But after a series of deaths in the family, she felt a calling to return to the family farm and pick up what was left. Since then, Barrett Duzan has made a name for herself, dipping her toes into agricultural leadership for women. Question, how long has your family been farming? The Barrett family has been farming in central Illinois for several generations, but in my lifetime and memory, that includes my grandfather and father. Our farming operation is a little unique. My grandfather, Gene Barrett, and father, Ron Barrett, farmed together for over 40 years. The natural progression was that my brother, Corey Barrett, would eventually take over the farm. Tragically, my brother passed away in a motorcycle accident in 2009 at 32 years old. My career was in TV journalism. I worked for the WAND-TV in Decatur for 7 years, leaving in 2011 as the morning news anchor. After the loss of my brother, my dad was looking for some help and asked if I would be interested. I just had my first child, and the thought was that this may give me a more flexible schedule, as my hours at the TV station were tough with a baby, with a 2 a.m. wake call, and often not returning home until well into the afternoon. So that's how my start on the family farm began. I was a farmhand for my dad for 7 years. Then we were suddenly faced with another tragedy. My dad was diagnosed in 2018 with advanced esophageal cancer. His battle was tough and short. We lost him just 6 months later. That is when I had to make a decision for our family on what we were going to do from here. My husband, Jared Duzan, having a full-time, stable career with benefits, it was up to me to decide if I wanted to try to keep the farm going for the next generation. I had a young son who was very close to my dad with big dreams of being a farmer. My father had that same dream for him. That, coupled with the thoughts of how hard my dad worked to grow and keep his operation, The answer was simple. Yes, I was going to give it a shot. With the support of my mother, husband, landlords, and farm managers, we made the transition happen and work successfully. Now, 8 years later, we are still going. My husband and I are now working side by side, and we still dream of growing and one day bringing our son, now 12, into the operation. The next question, where is your farm operation? We farm in the small town of Hume in Edgar County. This is where my entire family was born and raised. My mother still lives on a farm, while we live about 15 minutes away near Camargo. Our house is still within the Shiloh School District, so they get to attend the same school all of us went to and graduated from. Next question. How and why did your family come to this area, and where did they come from? If we are going really far back, the Barretts came here from Ireland. I believe they landed in Paris and spread out into Edgar County from there. My great-great-grandfather landed in the Hume area, and the generations of families grew and stayed in that area. Next question. What does your operation consist of? Is it strictly grain, livestock, or other? We are strictly a grain operation, growing yellow corn and soybeans. My dad and family raised pigs for many years, but ended that operation in the 90s. Next question. How many people in the family does the operation support? My husband left his career to join me on the farm in 2021, so we have had the wonderful opportunity of working side by side for 5 years now. Our farming operation supports us and our two children. Our daughter Callie is 15 years old and our son Colton is 12 years old. Question. Do you have any members of the family in the operation also working other jobs? My husband also has a side business outside the farm called HD Excavating. He and a co-owner work together to provide a variety of services such as sewer and water lines, ditch and drainage work, demolition, dirt hauling and removal, and field tile repair, among other things. I have also had recent opportunities to diversify our income. I have dipped my toe into agricultural-related speaking engagements. I was the keynote speaker at the Women in Ag conference in the Quad Cities this winter and have another event booked for December in Chicago. I shared my family's farm story and my leap from the anchor desk to the farm in a talk I called Fueled by Love and Legacy. I have also done some podcast appearances and magazine newspaper articles. This all stemmed from a documentary produced by a former co-worker a couple of years ago, telling our life story. It's called The Farmer's Daughter, and can be found on Amazon Prime or YouTube. Next question. What's your favorite snack while farming? That's a good one. My favorite snacks while farming are probably corn nuts and sour gummy worms. Long hours in the combine call for sweet and salty choices. Next question. Best agriculture show or movie? The best agriculture movie is The Farmer's Daughter, of course. Just kidding. But I do have to say, for a locally written, produced, and filmed and edited full-length biopic, they did an amazing job telling our family farm story. Scott England and Kylie Daniel from Half Moon Digital did all the work on the film themselves. Complete this sentence. While on the farm, I can't live without... While on the farm, I can't live without lots of water. I like to have water in the fridge, in my car, in whatever piece of equipment I am in. I don't like to go without. I have also been in a hot situation in the sprayer where I was super thankful I had several bottles of water in the cab to use before things got out of control. When on the farm, I'm listening to... Surprisingly, I like things a little quiet most of the time. Occasionally, I will turn on the radio to break things up, but I mostly like the quiet time to think. The best lesson agriculture has taught me is... Agriculture has taught me many, many things, from finances to how big even small choices can be. I'm not even sure where to start. For one, I can see now how important this job is to the world and the bigger picture outside of our tiny dot on the map. But I have also seen how important family and this lifestyle of getting to work together is, and how precious our time together is, even when it's not always fun. Three adjectives I would use to describe farming in East Central Illinois are... Three adjectives I would use to describe farming in East Central Illinois are fertile, flat, and fulfilling. Wow, she even got alliteration in there. How have you seen farming change over the years? While I have not been farming for that long, I have experienced some changes in my short years. The advancements of the use of drones for spraying has piqued my interest, although I'm not sure I want to invest in that technology just yet. I have dabbled and am still exploring the use of cover crops. I have also experienced the ebb and flow of good and bad financial times in farming. While some advancements make things easier for us, the increased cost to farm, while the future of return on investment remains questionable, makes farming more difficult. Your farm equipment, green, John Deere, red, Case IH, or other. Our family has always been a green farm. I know my dad has purchased a few red pieces in the past, but almost everything you will find in our shed is John Deere. What makes farming such a good vocation? I love farming because it doesn't always feel like a job. Don't get me wrong, it's not easy or something you can take for granted, but having some freedom to make decisions for yourself and solving problems and learning about new things keeps it exciting. Some things remain constant, but every year is a new start with different circumstances. Question: what soil conservation practices do you employ in your farm? We are a no-till operation. My dad went no-till decades ago, and my husband and I have continued that practice. We have also dabbled in some cover crops for conservation. We have used cereal, rye, oats, ryegrass, and radishes in the past. Question: if you could change one thing about farming, what would it be? One thing I wish I could change is the cost. It is not easy to get into and can be hard to stay. Land prices are astronomical. Taxes, interest rates, inputs, equipment, everything is expensive. It can be difficult to balance it all, and that is why every decision, big or small, is critical to the operation. Question: what's the best time of year to be on the farm? If you ask my husband, he would say planting is his favorite, but harvest is absolutely my favorite. The changing of the season, seeing the fruits of your labor, seeing the landscape change as the tall crops slowly start coming down, and the art of Oger cart, reading the mind of the combine operator and the trucks moving grain back and forth between the bin and the elevator. I'm not sure what an Oger, A-U-G-E-R, cart is. I like seeing all hands on deck and everyone knowing their job and doing it like a well-oiled machine. It also makes me feel especially close to my family. I think of my dad and my brother and life growing up and how lucky I have been to grow up in this lifestyle and be able to carry it forward with my family. So, readers of the News Gazette can look forward on every Wednesday through the harvest season of another profile of a farm family